I'm Marty Moscoe. Welcome to Radio Times. We all have an inner voice or voices, a running loop of self-talk as we go about our daily lives. That kind of dialogue, the ability to talk to ourselves, is one of the features that makes us human, that we have a self. Problems arise when this silent conversation becomes rumination, negative thoughts and emotions directed at ourselves. Our guest psychologist, Ethan Cross, is the director of the Emotion and Self-Control Lab at the University of Michigan, where he studies the science of introspection. He has a new book, Chatter, The Voice in Our Head, Why It Matters, and How to Harness It. He writes that chatter turns our capacity for introspection into a curse rather than a blessing. He explores the latest in brain and behavioral research, and he has tips on how to refocus, redirect our inner voices from the constant critic to the supportive coach. Ethan Cross, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here.
Can we say that all of us, all the time, even now, as you and I are talking to each other, have a running either monologue or dialogue, that we are constantly narrating our lives?
Well, it's not happening all the time. There's certainly moments where we're not experiencing that monologue. But we do have an inner voice that in some shape or form, one thing that I think is really helpful is to think of the inner voice as a kind of Swiss Army knife of the mind. It helps us do a lot of different things, everything from hold a piece of information in mind. If I asked you to, let's say, repeat a phone number silently in your head, your inner voice would let you do that. But it can also let you do lots of other things, like rehearse what you're going to say to someone in a conversation, or if you're giving a presentation. It helps us control ourselves, and it helps us narrate the story of our lives. So there are lots of different ways we could use this voice, and people vary in terms of how much they use it for different things.
Well, and what you're describing is our ability to multitask in many ways, that this inner voice helps us multitask.
Absolutely. The inner voice helps us keep certain kinds of goals activated. Like, when I'm doing something in the morning and trying to do 1,000 things at once, it's like, okay, remember to pack the kids' lunches. Of course, I don't do that anymore, pandemic times.
True.
But also, call my graduate students and make sure I don't leave my briefcase at home. So when you're anything having to do with using language silently in your mind, that's the inner voice. And it does tons of different stuff for us. So it really is, I think I use the language of a superpower in the book. And I don't use that phrase lightly. It really is quite astounding how important language is for our ability to successfully navigate our lives. I tell the story in the book about a neuroanatomist who had a stroke, which took out some of her language capacities. And, at first she described the experience as euphoric, because without having language, she no longer had that inner critic ranting. But she also lost so many basic abilities, the ability to make sense of her daily experiences, which was quite disturbing. So it is a superpower.
Well, let me quote from the book, and I really like sentence or two. You write, "The words of the mind sculpt the past and thus set up a narrative for us to follow into the future. By flitting back and forth between different memories, our internal monologues weave a neural narrative of recollections. It sews the past into the seams of our brain's construction of our identity." And obviously we need language to construct this identity of who we are. But it's interesting to think of it in terms of kind of a self-talk.
Yeah. Who is the language directed to, right? When it's happening silently in our head, it's directed to ourselves. We're often using language to make sense of our lives. Now, I want to be clear, we can also think in other ways, right? We don't always think in words, which is what we're talking about right now. We could also think in terms of images, like when you are, I won't project here, Marty, but when I think about, 10 months from now, I have a visual fantasy of sitting on a beach with pina coladas and lots of people all around
me. Too,
me.
Right.
so that's thinking in images, and we can certainly do that as well. But words make a huge part of our inner mental lives, right? We're constantly thinking about our lives in words too. So so that was what that sentence was trying to get at, the way in which we use language to make sense of who we are. And, you know, a point that is in that sentence that I think is important to maybe talk about is the fact that we're constantly traveling in time in our heads in order to make sense of who we are. We go back into the past to learn from our experiences, maybe to savor certain things that have happened to us. We also transport ourselves into the future. We try to imagine what's going to happen. And, you know, that capacity to time travel in the mind is an amazing, amazing tool, right? Because it helps us learn. It helps us plan. And I think that the current narrative is often that we should be in the moment as much as possible, which I think is, you know, being in the moment can be great some of the time, but I don't think we should lose sight of just how important thinking about the past and future is for us. And I think that the question is, how can we do it better?
As you talk about being in the moment, and I, you know, like a lot of people, I've tried meditation and I'm a complete and abject failure when it comes to being in the moment. You have that quiet time and then your brain, your memory, your mind just goes in a million different directions.
Well, you know, I think in part, so, you know, meditation can be incredibly helpful. And I think it's one kind of tool that exists for managing stress and anxiety and chatter. But you know, the current zeitgeist suggests that it's really like the only tool. I think that's an implicit take home. And that's not the case. There are countless tools that exist. And one thing to keep in mind is that we human beings, we did not evolve to be in the moment, in the now, all the time. To the contrary, we evolve the capacity to go back and forth in time, which makes us very, very different from other animal species, right? And again, I don't think we should try to stay away or work. It's almost like if you're always trying to be in the moment, you're working against the machine. You're working against the way we're built. And so what I try to talk about in the book is how we can, instead of working against the machine, how can we make our minds work more optimally? How can we go back and forth in time without getting stuck? And I think science has a lot to say about how to do that.
Well, indeed. And we've been talking sort of about the what I would describe as the more sort of upside of self-talk. Your book is about chatter, which is about when introspection becomes rumination, when we get sort of stuck on ideas or experiences and we begin to beat ourselves up. What is the purpose of that? Why do we do that to ourselves?
Well, I don't think we intend to do it most of the time. I think that's an example of having this very, very useful tool, this ability to introspect and use language to make sense of our lives and problem solve. We have this tool, but when we need it most, it often doesn't work so well. And so it's an instance of a tool that is useful in some contexts breaking down in others. And the challenge is to figure out when that happens, how do we bring it back on track? So when people experience negativity, we typically want to minimize that experience. And so we focus our attention inward. We introspect to do that. Chatter is what happens when we get stuck. We get caught up in the negativity and we start looping. So we ruminate about the past. We worry about the future. We catastrophize worst case scenarios and we don't find problems. And in the process, I think it's fair to say that, to use a technical term, we make ourselves nuts. And we sometimes, you know, make other people around us not so happy. So for me, what I've been trying to study for the past 20 years is, why does that happen, right? Why is it that some people, when they try to go inside to make sense of their problems, why do they get stuck? And when it happens, what can we do to bring them back on track? And the good news is that there are a number of different tools that exist, science-based tools for helping people get unstuck when those inner monologues take the wrong turn.
And I do want to get to the tools, but help us understand, are there certain people that are more susceptible to this kind of negative self-talk chatter as you describe it?
There are individual differences that predict it. Women show higher rates of chatter than men. I like to give the caveat there that you know, don't worry, women, though, because men show lots of other bad psychological effects on, you know, so it all balances out if you look across the plethora of harmful psychological tendencies. But this one in particular, women do show a higher propensity towards chatter. People who score higher on, you know, who are more neurotic, to use that phrase, also show a higher tendency. But the good news is that although there are some individual differences, we know that genes play some role. Early life experiences also play a role. We also know that genes and environment can interact in interesting ways to predict some of these chatter experiences. But all of that aside, the good news is that many of the tools that exist work equally well for men and women, for vulnerable and non-vulnerable groups. And so I think that's a very important take home, that although you might be more predisposed to have this experience, the tools work as well in many cases for those groups.
You know, I was wondering about whether the pandemic and all the stresses and anxieties of the pandemic, whether it's related to worrying about catching this virus or losing your job or trying to figure out how to educate your child, whether that has led to more chatter.
Well, I think it certainly has. We're actually doing some research in my lab on this right now, trying to understand what tools are people using to regulate their chatter surrounding the pandemic, and, you know, which combinations of tools are most effective. But what we're seeing is, you know, there's a threefold increase in rates of anxiety and depression compared to pre-pandemic times. And we know that chatter in the form of rumination and constant worry play a role in depression and clinical forms of depression and anxiety. So yes, I think we're seeing much higher levels of this now. We've got a lot of time, you know, that we spend alone with our thoughts. So a lot less time to be engaged with other people and engaged in behaviors that might take our mind off of those experiences. And we're living through a time of what I think is fair to say without any hyperbole is an unprecedented time of uncertainty and a lack of control. Like, you know, for the past year, you know, we've been living through political instability. We have economic uncertainty. And then we've got this once-in-a-century pandemic that we don't know what's going to happen. And so uncertainty and a lack of control are two ingredients that fuel chatter. So I think this is something that many people are struggling with right now.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's psychologist Ethan Cross. He's director of the Emotion and Self-Control Laboratory at the University of Michigan. He studies the science of introspection, and he's got a brand new book. It's called Chatter, subtitled The Voice in Our Head, Why It Matters, and How to Harness It. You can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always pick up the phone and call us the old-fashioned way. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Let me just recap what we're talking about, the fact that we all have an inner voice, a kind of running monologue, and it does help us sometimes to solve the problems that we face, but sometimes that inner voice becomes the inner critic taking us down what feels like a spiral of self-doubt. I'm talking with psychologist Ethan Cross. He has studied self-talk and introspection. He's got ideas about how to make those conversations more helpful, more insightful, and he's got a new book, Chatter, The Voice in Our Head, Why It Matters, and How to Harness It. One of the things you say, Ethan Cross, in terms of how to not just quell this inner critic, but be able to sort of understand what this inner critic is all about, is something called distanced self-talk. We talk to ourselves and we use the third person, and as you say, sometimes we even say our name out loud. What does that sound like?
Well, it sounds like when I'm going down the rabbit hole, you know, anxiously worrying about something. All right, Ethan, what are you going to do here? How are you going to get through this? So I'm actually using my name and the second person, you there. And, you know, one of the things we know, just to contextualize this tool and to explain why we think it's so useful, is we know that it's much easier for people to advise others on their problems than it is to follow that own advice ourselves. We actually have, there's a name for this in the literature. It's called Solomon's Paradox, named after the Bible's King Solomon, who was famously adept at doling out sound advice, but not following it in his own life. And so this is, I think, a very common experience. When I'm giving presentations, I often ask the audience, have you ever been in a situation where a friend or a loved one approaches you with a problem? They're spinning over, they're experiencing chatter, they don't know what to do, and they present the problem to you, and it's easy for you to coach them through it. And reliably, people raise their hands. Yes, they nod affirmatively. And so when it's not happening to you, you've got more psychological space, or what we call distance from the problem. It's easier to weigh in objectively. And what we've learned is that language provides us with a really efficient tool for gaining distance from our own experiences and getting that boost in objectivity. And it involves using your name to think about your life. You know, if you think about it, when do we use names or second person pronouns like you? Most of the time, we use it when we think about and when we refer to other people. So when you use those parts of speech to refer to yourself, it's almost like a psychological jujitsu technique. You're shifting people's perspective based on the words they're using really, really fast.
Almost like you're talking to another person versus yourself by saying Ethan Cross or Marty Moss Cohen or Diana Martinez.
Yeah, exactly. It's like you're having a conversation with someone else, with a caveat, right? It's another person whose inner thoughts and feelings we have privileged access to. What I mean by that is I can think all I want about what Marty's feeling right now. I can't possibly know. I can't, you know, we're on the phone. I don't know what you're feeling. I don't have telepathy. Science hasn't cracked that yet. But I do have access to what Ethan is feeling right now, like mostly excited, you know, a little bit tired and so forth and so on. So we do have access. So it's like a hybrid. It's like you're talking to someone else whose inner thoughts and feelings you have a direct readout on. And you know, I should add that when we study this, we always coach people to do this in the lab silently, not out loud. I think you want to be careful if you do it out loud, because it does powerfully violate social norms to have a conversation with yourself out loud. So if you want to avoid those raised eyebrows, you know, use this tool silently when you're in the midst of stress. Science shows that it helps people perform better and feel better during stressful experiences. They reason more wisely and so forth.
You include a letter that Fred Rogers wrote to himself. I guess he was going back to his TV show. This was obviously decades ago. And he addresses himself, come on, Fred Rogers, you can do this thing.
Yeah, there are countless, you know, anecdotes about people using these kinds of distant self-talk tools during times of stress. So I talk about Fred Rogers. One of my favorite anecdotes is Malala Yousafzai, the youngest person to win the Nobel Peace Prize. She tells the story of Jon Stewart, the former Daily Show host, asked her, you know, what went through your head when you found out that the Taliban were plotting to assassinate you? And she recounts to him her inner monologue. She says, you know, I used to think to myself, what would I do if a Taliban would come? And then I would say, Malala, just take a shoe and hit him. And so, you know, the moment she's in the first person, and then the moment she gets the situation in her head where she imagines the Taliban coming, she switches to coaching herself through the problem. Malala's not alone. Fred Rogers isn't alone. You see LeBron James, Jennifer Lawrence, Julius Caesar, Henry Adams, and countless others using this tool. And what's fascinating to me as a scientist here is, I think many of us stumble on tools that are useful. We stumble on them as we live our lives without even knowing it oftentimes, right? I don't think Fred Rogers or Jennifer Lawrence or Malala was consciously trying to control themselves by using their own name. They just did it. And why that happens, how people learn that, I think that's a really interesting question. What the science has done with not just that tool, but the 20-something others that I talk about in the book, the science has gone on to really systematically study how these different tools work and then lay them out for people so that we don't have to wait to stumble on them. We can be more proactive in how we use them.
Let me read a comment from Rick. He says, when I get stuck ruminating on the same thing for too long, I put things I'm thinking about down on paper to get them out of my mind. And he says, I find that very effective. Does that seem like a good thing to do?
Yeah. So is that Rick? Was Rick?
That was Rick, yep.
Rick, so, you know, I talk a little bit about this, or a lot in the book, actually. The way I would interpret that tool is when people are experiencing chatter, we often feel like we don't have control of our thoughts. Our thoughts feel out of order. And what we've learned is you can compensate for that experience, that lack of order you feel in your head, by establishing order around you, by organizing your space, or by creating a list, or neatly jotting down your thoughts in your case. And so there are actually, you know, lots of people who do this when they're under stress, and there's data to report that it alleviates that anxiety. So it's a way of compensating for the lack of order you have in your head by turning to something in your physical environment and reestablishing order in that way. And so I get into that a lot in the book.
Indeed you do. I was thinking, as reading Rick's comment, this happens to me that sometimes at 2 a.m. I am awake for, you know, no good reason. But, you know, then the chatter starts. And it's so easy when it's quiet, it's dark, and those thoughts begin to ruminate.
Yeah. And, you know, what's also really tricky about nighttime is that many of the tools we have at our disposal aren't as effective, right? Because, you know, we're essentially recharging our brains when we sleep at night. And so we don't have full access to the suite of tools that we might ordinarily bring to bear to help us in the, you know, in the midst of those 2 a.m. wake-ups where we're really struggling. So I think, you know, the challenge there is to try to figure out how you can manage your chatter before you go to bed, because right. If you nip it in the bud before that happens, then, you know, the sleeping mind converses with the waking one, and I get into that a little bit in the book too. So the more we can try to harness this chatter and lower the volume during our waking hours, the better.
And when that sun comes up, you say to yourself, what the heck was I? What was I so worried about at 2 a.m.? Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Ethan Cross. He's a psychologist and has spent years studying self-talk and introspection and self-control. And we're talking about his new book. It's titled Chatter, The Voice in Our Head, Why It Matters and How to Harness It. And again, we got questions and comments coming in, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. You talk about when that chatter is sort of invading your brain cells or your mind, the idea of sort of cleaning up and getting organized, writing things down. You also say literally going outside and experiencing awe, that really can shut down some of that negative chatter.
Yeah, I love this research. So, you know, awe is an emotion we experience when we're in the presence of something vast that we have trouble explaining or making sense of. So, you know, I consistently experience awe when I look up at the sky, when I can actually see the stars, which I can't always in Michigan in the winter, but when I can see the stars, I have trouble understanding how there are so many, you know, what does it mean for there to be billions of planets in the universe? Maybe there's no other life forms. There are. I can't compute that. It fills me with a sense of awe. I also have that feeling when I contemplate flying. Even though I fly all the time, I still don't quite understand how we figured out to blast human beings off in a tin can, so to speak, you know, get them up in the air and then safely land them. It's that level of innovation. It's just hard for me to contemplate. What we know is that when people experience that emotion of awe, it makes us feel smaller. We experience something that's called a shrinking of the self.
Huh.
When we're in the presence of something vast, we and our concerns feel a whole lot smaller. Like, I'm worried about the little argument I got in with my friend about, you know, who's picking up dinner, when I'm contemplating the vastness of the universe. It's a powerful way of putting our experiences in perspective. And science shows that it can help reduce chatter.
Let me read a couple more comments. James asks, and this is picking up on something you said earlier, Ethan Gross, what are the implications of talking out loud to yourself? Many people do it, but does it mean something? Are we stark raving mad, or is it normal? And I'm, you know, there are people who have things like schizophrenia who, I guess, have this kind of self-talk, this inner monologue or dialogue. What's the difference between the two?
Well, you know, you could take a lot of the tools. Well, let me back up.
Sure.
I think many of us have moments where we talk out loud to ourselves. Some people may even do it strategically to talk themselves through a problem. In those cases, I think it's very clear for those individuals that it's still themselves talking out loud to themselves. They're not having a conversation with another person. When you get into the domain of psychopathology, like schizophrenia, some of that reality testing falls off, right? It's not necessarily clear that there's not a person you're talking to, or for a person with schizophrenia is hearing voices. They don't realize that the voices are coming from them. They think that they're coming from another source. Like an alien is literally in their brain, as opposed to, you know, I can hear my mom's voice. I can hear it right now if I want to. Yep, she's telling me to clean up my room, right? Like, I know that's a simulation that I am initiating. So do some people talk out loud to themselves? Yes. The science on how effective that is surprisingly lacking. There haven't been a lot of studies looking at how useful that is. My hunch is that talking to ourselves out loud is another kind of distant self-talk that is useful. Most of the time when we talk out loud, we're talking to other people. So I think it probably is useful, but again, you've got to contend with those social norms. And so I would not advocate doing that in public, because sure, we're not used to other people talking out loud, right? We're used to people who have certain forms of clinical distress doing that. And so you need to be careful there.
You write about children. Here's an email from Margaret. How can we foster positive introspection in children? It seems that it would help them develop self-confidence, self-control, and manage emotions in healthy ways. Can you speak to that, Ethan Cross?
Yeah. So, you know, we do work with kids, and I have kids. And I think the first thing with kids is informing them, teaching them about how the mind works, I think is a really important gift we can give them. You know, I'm always amazed with my daughters who are young. It's not clear to them when they're ruminating about something or worried that they even have the choice to think or respond differently. Just making it clear that their thoughts are not their reality, that they have agency, their thoughts are not their destiny, I should say. That's a win, I think, for parents, right? For helping them, giving them a sense of autonomy and control. Once you do that, you can then go further. And you know, a lot of the tools I talk about in the book, some have been studied with kids, like distant self-talk, you know, has been studied with kids in the context of something called the Batman effect. When a kid's struggling with a really difficult task or a big emotion, they're frustrated, ask them to pretend they're a superhero. Wow. And actually use their superhero's name to coach themselves through the problem. So I might tell my daughter, pretend you're Wonder Woman. What would Wonder Woman do right now when she's really struggling with her homework? Would she give up? Superheroes don't give up, right? They persevere. And so that's one tool you can use with kids. I spend some time talking about how other people can be an amazing tool for us when it comes to our chatter. They can help us manage it, or they can make it worse. And so there's some complexity to it, but if you understand the science behind how to be a good support provider, a good chatter advisor to others, you can do that for your kids. And so when my kids come to me with problems, you know, I'll be there to empathically listen and hear them, to show them I care, but I won't just get them to keep venting the problem to me, because that doesn't help them solve it. I'll also try to steer them, try to give them advice or help them find out a solution on their own. And so there are ways of, I think, leveraging the science that way, too, to help your kids. So many things you can do there.
Sure. And going from kids to adults, as you say, you know, you can be, I guess, both a positive or a negative chatter advisor. Is it that people want to just unload how they're feeling, or do they want to figure out how to solve a problem? And if you're that listener, you're that friend, you're the person that they are talking to, how to be helpful under that?
Well, you know, I think a lot of people, when they confront us, do want to ultimately get help solving the problem. And if we're dealing with, and the issue is that a lot of people think that the way that to solve a problem is just to get it out, to vent the emotions. And, you know, this is a very popular idea. It's common in popular culture, and it dates back to Freud and Aristotle. But what research shows is that just venting your emotions, that in and of itself doesn't help us squash chatter. When we vent our feelings to others, we definitely feel more connected to the person we're talking to. Like, it feels good to know that there's someone there who cares enough about us that they're willing to listen to us. So it does strengthen our social bonds and makes us feel good in that regard. But after we're done having that vent session with that person, what research shows is that those negative feelings remain active, because when we're venting the problem, it's kind of like throwing logs on a flame. You keep the flame burning. And so in the healthiest kinds of exchanges, when people are looking to actually work through their problems, is to talk to someone who can do two things. Talk to a person who can both listen to you, empathize, validate your feelings, but then also try to nudge you to broaden your perspective. When we experience chatter, we're so tunneled in on the problem. We focus on it so narrowly. We forget about the different ways that we have, the different ways we can think about it that might make us feel better. So, you know, if I'm talking to you, Marty, about something, I might remind you, hey, you've had difficult interviews in the past. How have you dealt with them? Or here's how I've done it. And so lots of things we can do there to help broaden people's perspective.
Another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with psychologist Ethan Cross. We're talking about his new book, Chatter, The Voice in Our Head, Why It Matters, and How to Harness It. A lot of people want to join the conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We all have a running commentary rattling around in our brains. Problems happen when it turns negative and unhelpful. And I'm talking with psychologist Ethan Cross about his new book, Chatter, The Voice in Your Head, Why It Matters and How to Harness It. He runs the Emotion and Self-Control Lab at the University of Michigan. Let me pick up on something else. You were talking about distant self-talk, the idea of talking to yourself in the third person. You also talk about something called temporal distancing, imagining a better future. And you actually referenced Dan Savage, his, you know, It Gets Better campaign for LGBTQ kids and young people. Help us understand how that works to kind of quell this chatter.
Well, you know, this hits on what we were talking about before the break, on the idea that we can be chatter advisors to others. And I think technology, you know, social media provides us with an opportunity to do that on a massive scale. So what Dan Savage did in that campaign, the It Gets Better campaign, is for young teens that were really struggling with their identity and experiencing really difficult times, some of which led, like, part of what precipitated the movement were suicides that were committed because of the kind of negative feedback that gay teens were experiencing. You know, he posted a message, it gets better, with time it gets better. And this is something that we can do for others. We can do this for ourselves. We call it's a form of temporal distancing. And the idea is that when we're in the midst of experiencing chatter, we're again zoomed in on how awful the situation is. But one of the things we know is that situations tend to normalize with time, like lots of stressors, not all of them, but a lot. Take the pandemic right now. Like, this situation, I think, is objectively stinky, to use a technical term, for all of us. Like, it's not pleasant. And one of the tools that I will use to manage this myself is I'll use temporal distancing. I think to myself, all right, how am I going to feel 9 months from now once we're vaccinated and I'm back to traveling and doing the kinds of things I was doing before the pandemic? What that does is it makes it clear that although what I'm experiencing right now is really awful, it's temporary. It will eventually pass. And that gives me hope. And we know from lots of research that hope can be a bomb for chatter. It can really bring it down. And so that's one tool that people you can use at yourself. And you can try to do that for other people in your role as a chatter advisor.
What if, though, you know, the problems are even more stark and more real than that, that it actually won't get better, that what you're dealing with are some really heartbreaking, I mean, I don't even want to go to describe what I'm talking about, but really heartbreaking incidents, experiences, losses that someone has that isn't just after the pandemic is over, things are going to get better. No, they're not going to get better. This is what it is.
I'm so glad you brought that question up, because this brings us back to something that I believe very strongly in, which is there are no single magic bullets, no tools that work consistently for all people across situations. And you know, this goes back to our discussion of meditation and mindfulness at the beginning of the conversation, right? It's one kind of tool. We know that there are, you know, several tools. I review 20-something in the book. There are others. Different tools work for different people in different situations. So you're absolutely right. For an acute stressor of the sort that we're experiencing right now, that will, by all accounts, have an ending, I think temporal distancing makes a lot of sense. For other kinds of situations that are more chronic, temporal distancing probably isn't the strategy you want to use. And there are other kinds of tools that you can lean on. So I think, you know, part of the challenge here is to figure out what are the combinations of tools that work best for you in the different situations you find yourselves in. Again, no magic bullets. Anyone who says that there are, I would be really, really cautious of.
Let me get back to some of our listeners. Rebecca asks, what are the connections between chatter and tension in our bodies, the physical manifestations? How do we counter them?
Well, you know, one of the things I talk about in the book is how chatter is not just a subjective experience. As you're saying, it is a skin deep experience. It's one of the reasons that helps explain how stress gets under the skin. So stress in and of itself, having a stress reaction, that's not a bad thing. That's actually a good thing. You want to be able to quickly respond in the face of threat. What makes stress a killer is when our stress levels go up and remain elevated over time. And chatter helps us do that, because we experience something negative, say we're rejected by someone, and then what we do is we keep reliving that rejection experience over and over and over again. And in so doing, we're maintaining our stress reaction over time. So that explains how chatter can harm us physically. How we can mitigate that is to quell the chatter, to try to harness it, to you know, stop doing it. Once you stop doing the chatter, the negative symptoms tend to go away.
Here's another interesting question and comment. I find that sometimes in relationships, when we share a worry or our anxiety, instead of keeping it in our head, we can spark chatter in that other person. Is that a worry? The idea that you know, my chatter contaminates your chatter.
Yes. You know, I think it's a great question. These are fantastic questions, by the way, for all listeners. Keep them coming.
We have great listeners. What can I
say?
Yeah,
this is fun. what the listeners describing is what we call co-rumination, where I talk about my chatter, and you start talking about it, and then we start riffing off one another, making ourselves chatter, both filled with chatter. At the end of that, we feel close and connected, like we have a friend in one another and a partner who really gets us, but our chatter is through the roof, and so we're still suffering. And so what I tell people is I am extremely, extremely deliberate about who I talk to about my chatter. I know from experience who is adept at being a good chatter advisor. Like when I go to them, they listen to me, they hear me, they don't trivialize my experience or you know, make me feel silly. They hear me, but then they help me broaden my perspective. They help give me the kind of advice that's useful for working through those experiences. I go to those people. I have like a chatter board of advisors, like three people for personal problems, four for work problems. And I don't go to a lot of other people, some of whom I'm exceptionally close with. Like, there are people who I love a great deal and who also pretty sure love me back. I don't talk to them about my chatter because I know it's just going to make me feel worse, and I know it's going to make them feel worse. And so I think, again, this is an opportunity. This is where the science can be really useful. Understanding how to smooth those conversations can help guide us with respect to who to find to talk to about our chatter.
Here's a really interesting philosophical question. I mentioned in my introduction about the, you know, that we have a self. And David asks, when you ask yourself, what are we going to do? Who answers? Seriously, who is the self that answers versus who is the one that queries?
Oh, you saved this question for me with just a few minutes left. Not an easy question to answer. But, you know, I'm a belief that the self is a... It's a construction, right? It's a construction. Our self is dynamic. It's constantly changing. And we also know that there are different sides to our self, in the sense that there can be Ethan as professor, Ethan as author, Ethan as dad, Ethan as bumbling soccer coach, and we could shift back and forth. So it's a multifaceted concept. You know, when I'm having that internal conversation, I think... In all cases, it is me. I'm fully conscious that I am talking to myself and I'm giving myself advice, but I'm assuming different roles. In one case, I'm being, you know, more like my high school wrestling coach. In the other case, when I'm talking, coaching myself, and when I'm listening, I'm more in the role of a student. So, you know, I'm shifting roles as I talk to myself, which, again, we can do because the self is a complex psychological construction. That's the best you're going to get, listener, with this much time.
No, I think that's pretty good. I like the idea of self, just because I think it opens up this whole exploration about identity. It's interesting, too, to think of the voice or voices. I mean, these are, you know, I guess, people that have their parents, their grandparents, their coaches, their teachers, that they're all, you know, we have this cacophony, a chorus of voices in our head?
Well, you know, we can, and I think that varies for people. You know, some people describe. So, you know, just to go back to this idea of we all hear voices all the time, like our experiences are very, very unique as individuals in the world. Some people report hearing their mom, like, giving them advice, you know, when they're doing stressful situations. And for others, you know, their parents are absent. And so we certainly have that capacity to simulate the voices of others and hear their voices. But other people don't. And so I think there's a lot of texture to that experience in people's lives.
Let me read Ronald's comment, and then I want to read the comment from Chris. Ronald says, thank you for today's show. Now I know that I'm not crazy with all the internal conversations that I have with myself. I have been wondering about them. Chris says, I've given the voice in my head a name. Now I feel like they've developed into their own person. How do I know when it's getting out of control, and should I be worried about it? It's starting to feel like they are their own personality, and goes on from there. And perhaps, I mean, that's a tricky thing to try to understand. Any thoughts, Ethan, for Chris?
Yeah, well, I would say, you know, Chris, if you're having concerns that maybe they're, you know, the split is going too far, I think, go talk to someone.
Sure.
Get their opinion. They'll be able to do a complete assessment. You know, make sure you talk to someone who is accredited in an empirically, you know, validated form of intervention. And I think it's always good to err on the side of caution with these kinds of things. And with respect to the first comment from, I think it was Ronald, you know, thank you for that, because what is fascinating about this topic to me is the inner voice is, on the one hand, it's something that we all have experience with. It's a very intimate experience that we have with the voice in our head. But we don't often talk about it with others. And as a result, I think we don't know what's normal and what's not. And so part of what I hope to do with this book chatter is really normalize the experience of the inner voice for readers.
Picking up on Chris's comment, but also what you said about children, I think it's interesting to think about, you know, 7-8-year-olds who have vivid imaginations, often talk to themselves, sometimes have imaginary friends. And that can be a very helpful thing for a young person to literally have that imaginary friend that they can talk to.
Yeah. So, you know, many psychologists think that one of the ways kids first learn self-control is through self-talk. And the way this works is parents give instructions to their kids. Okay, Maya, don't do this. You should do that. And then kids go off and on their own, and they start having repeating those things that their parents say to them. They're in a certain sense rehearsing, right, what their parents are teaching them about how to control themselves. And so they're playing with their dolls. Okay, you shouldn't put this here. Then you should do this. And if you've been around kids, you often see them doing this. And the idea is that that captures the origins of self-control. It's about language. It's about self-talk. And eventually, those external conversations that kids have with themselves become internalized. They go inside their head. But the idea is we keep on relying on that tool to control ourselves throughout our lives. And so I think that self-talk is a very primitive, basic self-control tool. In the same way that touch, affectionate touch, is, you know, one of the first ways that we're soothed and regulate ourselves, language is also a very primitive tool.
Here's an email from Barbara. I started doing something that I thought was weird. Now I'm not so sure. When the chatter gets overwhelming, I picture Diana Ross and the Supremes singing Stop in the Name of Love. I sing it to myself to stop the chatter, remind myself that negative chatter is harming me. I should love myself. I think that's a great thing, Barbara. Let me squeeze in an email from David. Is there a psychological difference between self-talk and praying?
So yes, you know, praying, obviously, to the degree to which you're using, if you're praying silently, you know, that would be a way of using your inner voice to pray. But prayer does many other things beyond having a conversation with yourself. When you're praying, I would describe that as more of a ritual, which we know can have potent chatter relieving effects. What rituals do is they're like a chatter-fighting cocktail. They help you in a variety of ways. There's an order to prayer, right? Like, we say the same things over and over, so it can give you a sense of order and control. But prayers also connect us with something that goes beyond ourselves, it's a transcendent experience. We often pray in a collective, and we're praying to an entity, and that can elicit those awe-like effects that make our own concerns feel smaller. Prayer can also help broaden our perspectives too, because there's a higher power that is helping us. And so religion more generally can be a powerful tool for helping people manage chatter.
And we're almost out of time here, but this idea of ritual, of doing something that has meaning, obviously, but also has a certain, you know, way of doing itself. We're almost out of time, but just a quick comment on that, if you could.
Yeah, rituals, you know, cultures have been, rituals are a tool that we've been relying on to deal with chatter throughout the ages. I mean, if you think about when someone dies, cultures around the world prescribe rituals to help us manage the tumult that follows that experience. And many people rely on their own personal rituals. So Rafael Nadal, famous tennis player, tells the story in the book. He relies on a ritual to manage his anxiety on the tennis court. So they can be quite effective.
Well, Ethan Cross, thank you very much for joining us once again on Radio Times. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. The book is called Chatter, The Voice in Our Head, Why It Matters, and How to Harness It. And he studies introspection and self-talk. And he is, and I'm just scrambling here, oh, yes, director of the Emotion and Self-Control Laboratory at the University of Michigan. And we appreciate all those comments to Radio Times as well. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.